WTRN. The following program is being brought to you on the Voice America Business Channel. For more information about our network and to check our additional show hosts and topics of interest, please visit voiceamericabusiness.com. The Voice America Talk Radio Network is the worldwide leader in live internet talk radio. Visit voiceamerica.com. The views and ideas expressed on the following program are strictly those of the host or guests and do not necessarily reflect the views and ideas held by the Voice America Talk Radio Network, its staff, and management.
Are you interested in the cutting edge of investing? That means frontier and emerging markets. And would you like to get started? Or perhaps you are already investing but still have questions. Welcome to Emerging and Frontier Markets Investing with Gavin Graham. On today's program, we'll take a look at news, trends, and background information that you should know to become an informed investor in new and emerging opportunities. Now, here is your host, Gavin Graham.
Hello, I'm Gavin Graham, and I'm here with Emerging and Frontier Markets Investing each Wednesday morning at 9 a.m. Eastern, 6 a.m. Pacific, and at 2 p.m. in the UK. Each week, with my global roster of guests who include fund managers in major financial centers and also on the ground, and analysts and journalists who cover frontier and emerging markets, we try to look at what's happening, some of the major news stories, try to clear up some of the misconceptions about these markets, and suggest courses of action for you, the listener. I spent most of my professional life analyzing investments and hiring fund managers to handle large amounts of investors' money, and I figure I can spot the differences between promising investments and ones that are maybe not so promising. By emerging markets, we mean, of course, the BRIC countries. That's Brazil, home of the Soccer World Cup, at present gluing the attention of billions around the globe, Russia, India, and China, along with such other major emerging markets as Turkey, Chile, Mexico, and the Czech Republic. Today we'll have a report on Colombia, a country that sometimes is in the emerging market camp, sometimes is included in the frontier market, and where we've had a major presidential election. Talk about the results of that. By frontier markets, we mean, in general, the less developed countries, such as Vietnam, Nigeria, Kenya, Bangladesh, Kazakhstan, Ghana, Panama, Slovenia, and Slovakia. Today I'll have reports on Mozambique, on Indonesia, what one of my guests calls the ABCs, that's African blue chips, and some of the African countries that have those ABCs in them. And we'll be looking at connections between emerging and frontier markets investing and American foreign policy, which in fact is where we start. Some critics will argue that Barack Obama foreign policy has squandered some of the gains made in the previous administration, whether one agrees with its policy or not. The action, or perhaps lack of action, taken by the American government over the last few years have been cause for much concern. Whether President Obama deserves all this criticism is best left to history to decide, but today we're going to look at some of the connections between American foreign policy and what's happening in emerging and frontier markets. To do so, I have one of our regular guests, Paul DeSisto, on the line from New York. He's a senior portfolio manager at M&R Capital Management, which has over $500 million in assets under management. Welcome back, Paul.
Thank you, Gavin. Thank you for inviting me.
Not at all. Now, should we view American foreign policy, which obviously is a major determinant of what's happening in markets around the world, as having more or less effect on emerging and frontier markets than it did previously?
I think it's always been a factor, but I think it's generally a short-term factor, short-term influences. But they can give you good entry and exit points. For example, when the United States granted the former Soviet Union republics normal trade status, which we used to call most favored nation status, that was a good time to get in because it was a effect to make these countries enter into the international trade forum. So while I think the effects of policy in the United States, domestic and external or foreign, have an influence, I think it's generally more of a temporary thing, though on occasion some of the effects can linger a long time. I don't know what's going to go on with Argentina, given the loss they had in the Supreme Court yesterday when they upheld the lower court saying that they had to pay the bonds off. That may last for a while. So, yeah, it's a factor. At the end of the day, of course, you still have to buy good companies and go to countries where they will allow you to repatriate your capital.
Now, I mean, that's a very fair point, Paul, in terms of most favored nation trade status. And obviously, one of the biggest changes there was the creation of NAFTA, the North American Free Trade Agreement. Good heavens, it's 25 years ago now, which obviously had a massive effect in terms of American policy as far as Mexico was concerned. And talking of countries where there's good economic policy and where you can repatriate, Mexico would probably come fairly high up on the list. Would you agree?
I think Mexico is a place that's looking very, very good right now. We have a lot going on there. It's been in the news a lot, particularly with the activity taking place on the southwest border of the United States and the four border states. The Obama administration has taken a generally benign approach to the flood of people, generally children, coming from Mexico and seven of the Central American countries south of Mexico, like Honduras and Guatemala. In effect, he's not enforcing border security and immigration laws of the United States. Now, some observers may say he's doing this for domestic political reasons, to make sure that his party gets the votes of Hispanics coming into this country. Regardless of what one may believe in that regard, fact is that the movement of people, goods, and services between the countries is lubricated by this approach. It's a hands-off approach, or can I use an expression from 100 years ago, laissez-faire approach, at least in that regard.
Mm-hmm.
Yep. Mexico is our third largest goods trading partner, over $500 billion in 2013 alone. That's a very, very large sum of money. Just over $500 billion of it is in material, goods, and about $35 billion in services. So that's growing, too. There's a lot of what they call production sharing in the United States and Mexico as a result of foreign direct investing, which is facilitated by NAFTA. 40% of the goods imported from Mexico, in fact, have parts manufactured in the United States that are sent to Mexico and then returning from Mexico. In contrast, our production sharing with China was only 4%. So I do like the way Mexico is looking right now, on top of the fact that they had an election several months ago and the new president seems to be more attuned to allowing foreign direct investment.
Now, that's an important point, and making moves to actually do something about the sacred cow of Mexican business, which is Pemex, the state-owned oil company. What ways are there for investors to play Mexico as North American investors?
If one is willing to put up with a lot of volatility, they can go to a single country club, single country fund, excuse me, ETF. Now, the iShares Mexico capped ETF symbol EWW, that is 91% of its weight is in companies from Mexico in Mexico. In May of 2013, just before the crisis hit for emerging and frontier markets, when the Fed announced that it may start to tighten, The ETF was at 72. February 2014, just a few months ago, went all the way down to 59. Now it's back to 67. So a lot of that gain has come back. I think a better way to do it, if somebody's a little bit more risk averse, is to go through the emerging markets, Latin America. EEML is the symbol. It's still 25% Mexico, but it is less aggressive and. I think it has more to go to insofar as getting back to where it was in May of 2013. It's at 46 and it used to be at 51. But I'll say both of them look good on a technical basis. The 20 and 50 day moving averages are in an uptrend and the price is above both moving averages. So in that regard, I like that.
Well, moving from south of the border to the European sphere, could one talk about American foreign policy as far as the sanctions that were imposed on various groups within Russia as a result of the Russia-Ukraine crisis? How did that play out, and has it had any longer-term effect on Russia, or should one actually just regard it as you being, as you said at the beginning, being something of a short-term effect, and you really want to look at Russia as is this some way you want to be long-term?
That was a very interesting case with Russia. I did a study on some of the foreign trade, and I noticed that actually foreign trade between the two countries has grown 2012 to 2013 and 2014. And every month this year, January, February, March, and April, mono trade was greater than in 2013, which in turn were greater than 2012. So the sanctions we did were against a few Russian citizens and companies that had close ties to Vladimir Putin. It may have had an effect on their wallets, but insofar as the actual investing between the two countries and the trade, it really hasn't. And the largest of the Russia ETFs, the Spider symbol RBL. It dropped from 26 to 21 as the crisis began in March. It's all the way back to 26 now. So, of course, we've also seen that the Crimea crisis and the Ukraine crisis, that's gone on the back burner because we have more important things, or not necessarily more important, but more publicized things going on in Iraq right now and in the southern border of the United States with Mexico. So Russia's sort of fallen into the background, and all that money, all that drop in investments that took place beginning in March has all been made back.
That's a very good point there, Paul. Just as a final sort of geographical area, what about the African continent? Because obviously there was a major move by the last president but one, President Clinton, to actually attempt to grow trade within Africa. Did that have any effect? And are there some numbers to back that up?
Frankly, I'm quite excited about Africa. I think that's where a lot of activity is going to take place. In 2000, President Clinton did try to increase the amount of trade going there with AGCO, the Africa Growth Community Organization, if I've got that right. And we started actually trading with them. But it's important to remember that this was a very incipient thing, and it was designed more as a political act to try to get these countries to enter into the World Trade Organization and become basically members of the World Trade community. So, notwithstanding that, it's very, very modest goals. It's worked quite well. Trade has picked up significantly with a lot of these countries, and a lot of them are doing good. Foreign direct investment, sub-Saharan Africa, 22% increase compounded from 2008 to 2012. In North Africa, it stagnated, and I'm talking mainly here about sub-Saharan because you've had all these issues in North Africa, Libya, and so forth, and Egypt. The major beneficiary countries of it have been Ghana, Nigeria, Mozambique, Kenya, Tanzania, Mauritius, and South Africa. And remembering my undergraduate days in world history, all those countries except Mozambique were British possessions from where the common law was spread throughout the entire British Empire. And in fact, the World Bank has indicated Ghana, Nigeria, and South Africa as already being classified as middle-income nations. So there's a lot of progress going on there. And if you look at the sub-Saharan GDP, 2004, $561 billion, 2017, $1.84 billion. So it's really gone up dramatically. And I think that's what a lot of the opportunity is going forward, even more so than in Southeast Asia.
So just to finish up here then, Paul, what ETFs would be available for investors looking to get some exposure to Africa, particularly sub-Saharan Africa?
The emerging markets, Europe, Middle East, Africa, is 37% Africa. The symbol on that is EMEA. That is the most heavily weighted one towards sub-Saharan Africa. Another way, if one is willing to have some other frontier nations, these would include some North African, Middle East, and Southeast Asian countries, the MSCI Frontier 100, symbol is FM. That does have Nigeria 8.6%, Kenya 3.2%, and Mauritius 1.2%. So you're talking about 15% in Africa there. And again, that might be a little bit more stable because it is spread across more areas than the EMEA, which is 37% Africa. The reason it's not 100% mm-hmm. Africa, of course, is many of the investments are European and U.S. multinationals that invest directly in those countries. And if one really has a lot of guts, they can go to the Global X Nigeria emerging markets. The issue with that, of course, is we see what's going on with Boko Haram. They do have an Islamic problem there, internal war, so that's something to consider.
Absolutely, but it's an interesting point about the European multinationals because several of our other guests have suggested they're a pretty good way to play Africa. But our next guest will be talking about the possibility of maybe some individual African investments. Thanks very much indeed, Paul, for looking at the effect that U.S. foreign policy has had on various regions and ways that it may have affected or, in some cases, not affected things.
Thank you, Gavin.
Thanks. Our thanks to Paul DeSisto at M&R Capital Management in New York for that look at connections between U.S. policy and what's happening in emerging and frontier markets. Interesting stuff about the fact that Russian trade with the U.S. has continued to grow all through the crisis this year. Just before we go to the break, it might seem difficult to imagine an oil-rich company in the Middle East having money problems, but we talk about one such possibility in the current edition of our new newsletter, the EFMI newsletter. If you'd like to find out more, please write to info@emergingfrontier.ca or call 888 888- 287-8229. Again, that's info@emergingfrontier.ca. You can also buy it immediately at our discounted price of $94.99 by going to www.emergingfrontier.ca/newsletter. When I come back to the break, I'll be looking at African blue chips in Africa. Please stay with me for that.
Think you've seen everything there is to see in online television? Let us surprise you. Visit voiceamerica.tv today for sports, health, business, and more on demand 24/7.
This program is produced by EFMI Media, which has become the leader in information about emerging and frontier markets investing. EFMI recently compiled the book entitled Investing in Frontier Markets: Opportunity, Risk, and Role in an Investment Portfolio, set for release by John Wiley & Sons later this year, and another book, also on frontier markets, which will be on store bookshelves later in the year. We are also launching a newsletter called EFMI. For more information, email info@emergingfrontier.ca. For more news about upcoming program segments, the books we have written, or the EFMI newsletter, please email info@emergingfrontier.ca. You can call 416-944-1750.
My name's Ken, and I am as general a contractor as you'll find. I do
kitchen remodeling, additions, plumbing, painting. Ken does it all. And I'm Mandy,
the owner of the UPS store in my neighborhood. And Mandy here does it all, too. She
handles Ken's packing and shipping. Because when you're remodeling a bathroom and a client
changes their mind on a light fixture or a mirror, Mandy packs it up and ships it out. She also
helps Ken promote his business, like with these new brochures we printed, new business cards.
And the flyers are great, too. In fact, when I'm at a job and I'm expecting a delivery,
I sign for it. I even let him know with a text or email.
Since I got a mailbox at the UPS store. I have to say, as much as I love being on my own, I'm not alone. I've got Mandy here.
To help with the heavy lifting?
Well, figuratively speaking.
To find a locally owned center near you, visit theupsstore.com. We love small businesses. We love logistics. The UPS store franchise locations are independently owned and operated. Services, pricing, and hours of operation may vary by location. See center for details.
From the boardroom to you, Voice America Business Network.
You are tuned into Emerging and Frontier Markets Investing with Gavin Graham. To connect with our program today, please call in to 1-866-472-5790. That's toll-free in North America, 1-866-472-5790. You may also send an email to info@emergingfrontier.ca. Now, back to the program.
Welcome back to Emerging and Frontier Markets Investing. I'm Gavin Graham. So as we were discussing with our last guest, Paul DeSisto, there are obviously ETFs which allow you to invest in Africa, and that can give you a fairly good exposure generally to the continent. But obviously, as a number of our guests have pointed out, Africa is not just one market. It's a number of markets which have different characteristics. And there are some experts who believe that there are other ways of getting exposure. One of them has been with us several times, and we're delighted to have him back. That's Thomas Mims at Emerging Africa. Welcome back, Thomas.
Oh, Gavin, thanks for having me back.
Now, in our last conversation a couple of weeks back, we talked about your concept of ABCs, that's African blue chips, but we didn't really get into a great deal of detail. For those of us who weren't with us, and for those who would like to know more, could you just outline what you mean by African blue chips?
Well, the African stock exchanges have developed at different stages and to varying degrees. Parenthetically, I will say that you don't hear me speak too much about South Africa because of the access through ADRs and GDRs. So yeah. I'm not excluding, and I don't know if South Africa really is in the category of a frontier market. Now, some of the other markets are efficient, which has enabled certain countries to attract relatively large amounts of foreign capital. Excuse me. These markets are in Morocco, Nigeria, Kenya, and Mauritius. They're all T+3, meaning that you get rapid or prompt settlement in 3 days.
Yep.
And so, therefore, they're the most liquid. So you could say I could paraphrase and say what I'm talking about here is liquid Africa and overachieving and undervalued listings. Historically, African stock markets have not been vibrant. Most of the African stock markets have a market capitalization of less than $10 billion U.S. dollars, with some of them at a few hundred million dollars. Sprinkled throughout the continent, there is a stable core of consistently successful enterprises. Trading exchanges offer significant growth opportunities. Now, these African equity markets thus far have not lured the so-called hot money or highly volatile short-term firms, which many analysts have blamed for exaggerating the peaks and troughs of emerging market investment. I would say that rather many of the continent's best-performing stocks are in the hands of institutions following a buy-and-hold strategy, including governments maintaining minority holdings and those involved in management. Now, such investors do offer some stability to share prices on the plus side. I should say also on the plus side, this investor can be a buffer offsetting price volatility. The low liquidity levels of most African...
An important point.
Yeah?
I was going to say that's an important point, obviously, because it is good to have strategic shareholders who are there for the long term. But please continue, Thomas. You were about to say...
I was just going to say the low liquidity levels of most African stock exchanges is often cited as a barrier to market expansion. For example, I'd say, in my estimation, 60% of the African stock exchanges currently have annual turnover ratios of less than 10%. So what back to, as you mentioned, our category that we like to call the African blue chips, and what I'm going to do is give you some examples of selected African blue chips. Now, to go over once again, these markets are Morocco, Nigeria, Kenya, and Mauritius. Now, what do we mean?
Right.
What do you have to do to qualify to be an ABC? Well, you have to pretty much be in those markets.
Yep.
They're all T+3 markets. We're looking in that category of companies with a market cap of at least $200 million.
Yep.
Also audited by the top CPAs such as KPMG, Deloitte, Pricewaterhouse, Ernst & Young, etc. So, Gavin, I'll name a few. Okay.
Absolutely. Why don't we do it by country? So, which country did you want to start with?
All right, I'll start out with Kenya.
Yep.
Okay, we're looking at Equity Bank. It has a market capitalization of $1.8 billion. The current share price in U.S. dollars is 49 cents. There's 3.7 billion shares issued. Equity Bank is Kenya's largest lender. Presently, it plans to launch a mobile telecom service just next month, in July. In partnership with Airtel Kenya, that's Kenya's second-largest mobile operator, the bank will open a platform that allows its customers to make payments and cash transfers from their mobile phones under its recently awarded Mobile Virtual Network Operation, or MVNO, license. This will be first in Kenya and in Africa to offer a full banking suite through an MVNO. Under the MVNO, every SIM card will be a debit card, enabling customers to pay for goods by tapping their phones on a mobile point-of-sale terminal. Another Kenya firm is ARM, which is also was known before as Athi River Mining. And it's a major cement producer. It's also in the mining sector, agriculture and food, construction and roads, and it also has a division that specializes in environmental projects. So there's a couple from Kenya. I'm going to go on to Mauritius, okay?
Could we do Morocco, if we may, because there's a couple of fairly large companies there.
I beg your pardon?
Could we do Morocco?
Okay, sure. We can do Morocco. Let's say, like, Morocco Telecom.
Right.
Now, that company actually trades on the Moroccan Stock Exchange. Its market capitalization is a little above $10 billion. And the share price, last time I looked in U.S. dollars, was $11.64. It has 879 million shares plus issued. Moroc Telecom is the largest mobile and only fixed-line operator in Morocco. It has agreed, the company's agreed to acquire the West African operations of Emirates Telecoms Corp. That's called, also known as Etelesat. That acquisition will be $650 million. The company has operations in Benin, Central African Republic, Gabon, Ivory Coast, Niger, and Togo. Now, this agreement will also include Prestige Telecom, established in Ivory Coast, which provides IT services to the operations of Etelesat in these countries. Etelesat has operations in 15 countries in the Middle East and Africa and Asia. The acquisition is part of a transaction agreed to this past November, where Etelesat will acquire Vivendi's SA's 53% in Moroc Telecom for $5.8 billion. Another ABC in Morocco would be BMCE. It has a market cap of $4.5 billion. The share price, last time we looked, was around $25. It has around 180 million shares issued. It's also listed on as a GDR on Portal. Right. And on the London Stock Exchange. The bank last year became the first private financial institution in North Africa to issue bonds in international capital markets. It plans to use $300 million raised in a bond sale to accelerate expansion across Africa.
So, Thomas, just finishing up here with Nigeria, because we're beginning to run into the break, but a couple of the stocks in Nigeria that you think would count as ABCs. One of them is a bank, isn't it?
Yeah, there's a couple. I'll give you Guarantee Trust Bank. That's also known as GT Bank. A market cap of $5.4 billion. And the share price last time I looked, 18 cents. Issued shares, $29 billion plus. GT Bank became the first Nigerian and African bank to issue a full listed GD offering on the London Stock Exchange. It also listed as a GDR on the Deutsche Börse and Portal. And then there's also Zenith Bank there. And one other I want to mention, if I have a moment, is Dangote Cement, which has a market cap of just about $24 billion. Share price in U.S. dollars right now, $1.40. 17 billion shares out there, and it is it's Africa's largest cement producer. It also has a separate issue called Dangote Sugar Refinery, which is one of the largest sugar refining companies in the world.
No, so, there are certainly, as you made clear, some interesting high quality companies. Some of them fairly sizable, like Dangote or Moroc Telecom, and as you say, they've actually got accounts audited by the Big Five. They have some liquidity, and they're a decent size. So you'd certainly suggest, I think, Thomas, these might be a way people could gain exposure to Africa, correct?
Oh, most definitely. And of those markets, as you say, they're the normal way. And I would we estimate ourselves here, right in our little company, that there's over 100 African stocks on these markets that could pretty much qualify for what we call our ABCs.
Well, that's an interesting thought, and I'm sure we'll have an opportunity to actually look at a few more of them when we speak next. Thanks very much indeed, Thomas.
All right, Gavin. Good being on again. Thank you.
Thanks. Our thanks to Thomas Mims at Emerging Africa for that lesson in ABCs. When I come back from the break, I'll be looking at the results of the runoff presidential election in Colombia, which we talked about with Rupert Stebbings last week, and we're back to actually see who won, and then we'll be looking at the pros and cons of investing in an African nation that may be overlooked. Please stay with us for both of those segments.
From the boardroom to you, Voice America Business Network.
This program comes to you from the EFMI Media Company. EFMI Media is one of the most comprehensive sources of information and analysis on emerging and frontier markets. EFMI Media has become a leader in knowledge, expertise, and analysis of emerging and frontier markets, both in opportunities to investigate and pitfalls to avoid. For further information about EFMI Media, go to www.emergingfrontier.ca or call 416-944-1750. EFMI Media produces this program, researched and wrote Investing in Frontier Markets, Opportunity, Risk, and Role in an Investment Portfolio, which is set for release later this year, and is currently working on a second book, also on Frontier Markets. EFMI also publishes a newsletter called EFMI Information and provides knowledgeable speakers on these and other topics. For further information about EFMI Media, go to www.emergingfrontier.ca, write to info@emergingfrontier.ca, or call 416-944-1750.
From the boardroom to you, Voice America Business Network.
You are tuned into Emerging and Frontier Markets Investing with Gavin Graham. To connect with our program today, please call in to 1-866-472-5790. That's toll-free in North America, 1-866-472-5790. You may also send an email to info@emergingfrontier.ca. Now, back to the program.
Welcome back to Emerging and Frontier Markets Investing. I'm Gavin Graham. As I mentioned before the break, last week we were talking to one of our regular contributors, Rupert Stebbings at Valores Bancolombia in Medellin, about the unresolved presidential election in Colombia. Ex-finance minister Oscar Zuluaga had won the first round, polling more votes than incumbent president Juan Santos, but neither candidate got the 50% plus one vote majority required for victory, and a runoff election was held on Sunday. Santos won comfortably over Zuluaga. So to get a clearer picture of what exactly happened between the two rounds of the election and what the outcome is likely to be for the Colombian market, I have Rupert on the line from Medellin for an update. Welcome back, Rupert.
Hi, Gavin. Good to be here.
Thanks. Is it fair to say the uncertainty of the runoff caused some jitters in the Colombian stock market between the election and the runoff on Sunday?
Yeah, I think as we mentioned last week, it was a fairly ugly election campaign, right up to the finish, to be honest, with claims, counterclaims. And basically, whilst the foreigners kind of, they've seen all this before, the locals, you know, they don't like to see this up close. And the country did split into two in a fairly obvious manner. And yeah, I mean, it was ugly and it caused a lot of uncertainty. We didn't see massive volatility, but at the same time, everyone just stayed on the sideline.
Now, I understand you have been graced by a visit from U.S. Vice President Joe Biden, following on from our thoughts about U.S. foreign policy. How long is he going to be in Colombia for? Presumably just to congratulate Mr. Santos on his win. And is this likely to have any effect apart from an acknowledgement of the victor?
Well, he flew in from Brazil overnight. He's here for the morning, and then he flies on to Dominican Republic, I believe. And he's here really, I think it was already scheduled, but he's here really to congratulate him and to basically, it's a photo opportunity, and also the US has been fairly vocal in supporting the peace process, and that would be top of the agenda without a question. He'll want updating. Obviously, Santos ran on a peace process mandate, which he's now saying he has. So Biden's obviously going to want to hear what are the next steps and how they can help, I'd imagine.
So, I mean, as you said, it was a fairly ugly election. There's a report that over 600,000 spoiled ballots. Is that a protest of sorts at the ugliness of the campaign? And does it detract at all from Santos's win?
No, I mean, in the first round, we had a lot of spoiled ballots, or blank votes, as they're called here. I mean, there's some big issues with the campaigning and voting here. I mean, first of all, you know, when you get a 50% turnout, it really isn't satisfactory. And secondly, the amount of spoiled ballots. We had that in the first round. A lot of people spoiled ballots because, I mean, obviously they weren't clear. They weren't happy with either candidate. There was also a segment who had never been happy with presidents running for a second term. I think it was there was a few politicians vocally saying that was the way to vote if you weren't happy with either of the candidates. I don't think it detracts at all, but I think it's also part of a democracy. If people aren't happy with the two presidents, maybe it's better to do that than sit at home watching the football.
Mm-hmm. Although, of course, Colombia in the World Cup for the first time in 16 years and a winner, so that's obviously good news and maybe has cheered a few people up. Other people who might be cheered up presumably would be people expecting the privatizations that Mr. Santos has started. We discussed those last week, but could you briefly just remind us which of the two companies are likely to be most affected?
I mean, it's Isagen, which is the huge energy company here. That was in the middle of a sale process, which was supposed to be concluded before the election. It wasn't, because things do tend to take time in Colombia. So Isagen, the sale process is now back on track. That's 67% of the company that the government are trying to sell. It's a multi-million-dollar sale, and the funds have already been earmarked for the huge infrastructure projects here. So that will go ahead. And the other stock that people were very concerned about was Avianca. Because Avianca is obviously in the midst of negotiating with the Venezuelan government about $300 million it's owed to them. Obviously, Álvaro Uribe and Venezuela have something of a track record. And the concern was that Uribe being the backer of Zuluaga, if Zuluaga had won, maybe we'd see problems again with Venezuela, and that might have torpedoed somewhat the negotiations for Avianca. But that hasn't happened, so Avianca were more optimistic. Having said that, yesterday Avianca were one of 16 airlines that said no to Venezuela's first proposal, so we'll have to see how that develops. But in our opinion, anyway, we've modelled Avianca as if they haven't received a penny, and it's still got plenty of upside for us.
Okay, that's interesting thoughts. So just to finish up here, Rupert, as you mentioned, the peace process is obviously going to be, or the continuation of the peace process is going to be one of the major sort of focuses for President Santos. Is there any other one issue or two issues that you think he might want to focus on that are a major concern?
I think investors should perhaps concern, first of all, we're going to have the legislative agenda fixed in the next couple of days. One thing that's come up overnight, really, is the subject of royalties on the oil companies. We saw Ecopetrol and Rubiales have very bad days yesterday, in part because the government's already announced that Ecopetrol's production will miss targets this year and probably next year, I'd imagine. Well, rather, they announced that the country would miss, but having said that, Ecopetrol is the majority of the production. So there's talk of raising royalties here. Royalties here are considered very generous versus other countries, so I think Ecopetrol and Rubiales holders need to keep an eye on that situation. The other thing the country is crying out for is justice reform. The justice system here is a multi-strata. It's a mess, to be absolutely frank. There's too many people involved. There's not enough transparency, and both sides have been calling out for a justice reform. And the other thing that most obviously will come is a fiscal reform, is a tax reform. The system here is very complicated. They have been making it less complicated, but I think we'll see another tax reform, and people are keeping a foreign eye on that. Apart from that, it's a usual litany of subjects that need looking at, education, health. There's a lot of different aspects. But apart from the peace process, I'd be watching out for a justice reform and also to see what happens with royalties for the oil companies.
Okay. Thanks very much, indeed, Rupert. Well, there's some resolution there with President Santos re-elected, but obviously still lots of issues to keep an eye on. I'm sure we'll be back talking to you again soon.
Pleasure as always, Gavin.
Thanks. And now back to Africa. I have Africa consultant Aubrey Harubi on the line from Washington, where she's just got back from a visit to the continent. And having spoken about Ethiopia as a market that might not be top of mind for many African investors, now we're going to be looking at another country that might also not be on the radar screen, although interestingly Paul DeSisto mentioned it as one of the countries that had actually done best out of the Africa Growth Act. This is Mozambique. Welcome back to Emerging and Frontier Markets Investing, Aubrey.
Thank you so much, Kevin.
Not at all. Now, Mozambique, of course, was torn apart by 15 years of civil war that ended in 1992. Some analysts have suggested that there might be a possibility of that fighting re-erupting, but others, such as Fitch, believe there's little risk. What would your assessment be, having visited?
I see that as a far-off possibility, that there's really little chance that they'll return to fighting. There have been a few instances of political violence in the last year, but they have not been widespread, and there's little public support for it. So I think you can toss it up to more kind of pre-election and political violence than a widespread movement.
And just briefly, a few details on Mozambique, because I'm sure it's a market that most of our listeners won't be very familiar with. How big is the population? GDP growth, I presume, has been fairly strong. Is it a big resource play, or is there a major consumer sector as well?
Like all African countries, the consumer sector is emerging. However, Mozambique is majorly focused on resources, both in mining and oil and gas. The mining sector is really driving the growth. GDP growth grew at 7.2% over the last about 8 years, and Vale and Rio Tinto are the big players. In fact, Mozambique will be one of the top 10 coal exporters in the world by 2017. And then in terms of oil and gas, there have been significant fines. Anadarko and Eni are the big players there. And they've found more than 100 trillion cubic feet of natural gas. So Mozambique is expected to become a pretty significant LNG exporter to Asia in the next 10 years.
Is it a member of OPEC?
It is not. Like many African countries, it is not a member of OPEC. It's not yet a producer of oil, so the issue is a little bit kicked to the future. That said, Mozambique has received loans from the OPEC Foundation for infrastructure over the years. So OPEC's been active in Mozambique, but I don't see much chance of joining, at least not for another 5 to 10 years.
So when we were talking about Ethiopia, you suggested that the best way to play that country, given the illiquidity and absence of settlement systems, would be worked through well-known multinationals. Much the same for Mozambique?
Indeed. The local capital market is very small. There's only five companies listed. So the best play is to come in through some of the multinationals. In that area, you have some of the biggest players being the ones I listed, Vale, Rio Tinto, Anadarko. But you also have others in the consumer goods space like SAB Miller, for example, or the South African retailers ShopRite and Pick n Pay. There's also a hotel chain, Minor International, that just took over three properties in Mozambique. So if someone is looking for exposure to the growing tourism sector, there's a way to get in there as well.
And are there any funds that investors might be able to access that specialize in, say, private area or individual sectors?
There are. Most of them are quite small. However, the Carlyle Fund bought into a transport company, J&J Transport, that's very active in northern Mozambique near the mining areas. So the Carlyle Fund provides some exposure. And then Eurofin Strong Eagle Mozambique Fund was just launched. It's very small. I think it's $25 million. But they're focused on commercial real estate in Maputo. So you really get a diverse look at the economy with these new emerging sectors coming up. And investors do have some of these specialized funds. There are a couple others that are being raised currently that will focus on Mozambique.
Interesting stuff indeed, because certainly it's not a market that's been on, I think, many people's radar screen, even the Africa funds. So interesting to see that there are some early movers getting in there, and there are even specialist funds. Thanks very much again, Aubrey. We do appreciate the insight that you bring to Africa, and we'll be back talking to you again soon, I'm sure.
It's a pleasure. Thanks much.
Thanks. Our thanks to Africa consultant Aubrey Harubi for that look at a country that some Africa investors might not have considered. But again, there's a specialist Mozambique property fund raising $25 million to buy property in Maputo, the capital. I won't say who knew, but it is interesting to see how effective the capital markets are at giving people the opportunity of getting exposure. We have a break coming up, but just before we go there, if you're interested in a bank that has 90% of its earnings from emerging and frontier markets and has actually taken something of a hit because it didn't grow its earnings last year after a decade of strong growth, please read our new publication, the EFMI newsletter. If you would like more information, write to info@emergingfrontier.ca or call 888-287-8229. When I come back to the break, I'll round out today's program with a look at Indonesia. Please stay with us for that.
From the boardroom to you, Voice America Business Network.
Do you like what you hear about investing in emerging and frontier markets on this program? Would you like to learn more to increase your investing effectiveness? EFMI Media also publishes a subscription-based newsletter called EFMI. We'd like to tell you more about it. Drop us an email at info@emergingfrontier.ca. We've designed EFMI as a newsletter to provide expert and up-to-date news and analysis of opportunities in the same markets that we discuss here on Emerging and Frontier Markets Investing with Gavin Graham. EFMI has information and analysis that you won't find anywhere else, and you can start receiving it by emailing info@emergingfrontier.ca.
The way we do banking today continues to evolve. No longer is it just brick-and-mortar locations or traditional banker's hours. Today, banking is 24/7. It's in the home. It's on the go. It's digital. Tune in to Breaking Banks with Brett King for a look at how traditional banking as we know it has changed due to a loss of trust, changing economic conditions and consumer behavior, government involvement, and, of course, technology. What does it all mean? Listen every Thursday at 3 p.m. Eastern Time, noon Pacific, on the Voice America Business Channel.
From the boardroom to you, Voice America Business Network.
You are tuned into Emerging and Frontier Markets Investing with Gavin Graham. To connect with our program today, please call in to 1-866-472-5790. That's toll-free in North America, 1-866-472-5790. You may also send an email to info@emergingfrontier.ca. Now, back to the program.
Welcome back to the final segment of Emerging and Frontier Markets Investing. I'm Gavin Graham. Just before I go to our next guest, does the concept of investing in a fund that can invests in other frontier market funds appeal to you as a means of spreading the risk, especially as both the fund itself and the fund, some of the funds it's investing in, sell at a discount to their underlying asset value? If so, please check out our current edition of our new publication, the EFMI newsletter, info@emergingfrontier.ca or 888-287-8229 will give you more details. Now, as I mentioned before the break, let's have a look at a major oil and gas producer, Indonesia. We know that the countries of the Middle East control much of the world's oil and gas. And, of course, Indonesia has been one of the long-standing members of OPEC. I have energy economist Carol Nackley on the line from London, who was in Indonesia as part of a major trip just a couple of weeks ago. Welcome back to the program, Carol.
Thank you very much, Gavin.
So one of the issues with Indonesia has been that I believe that it's actually seeing something of a decline in its oil and gas production. Is that correct? And if so, what are the forces behind that?
Indeed. I mean, both oil and gas production peaked, natural gas production peaked only recently, actually in 2010, but they have been both on decline since. And the main problem in Indonesia today is the lack of adequate investment. Currently, oil and gas producers or companies, international oil companies such as Chevron, BP, ExxonMobil, are actually complaining about the regulatory uncertainty that they have to face in Indonesia and the bureaucracy and the length of time it takes to approve licenses to pursue their developments and investments. So this is currently the situation, not very pleasant, but I think the Indonesian government are sending signals that it wants to reverse the situation and increase its production again. Whether they'll be able to do so, we have to wait and see.
Because how important are the oil and gas sector to the overall Indonesian economy? Presumably pretty important, although maybe less so than previously, thanks to the growth of domestic manufacturing.
Indeed, I mean, we don't find the same dependence on oil and gas sectors as you find in countries such as in the Middle East, where, for example, in Iraq, you have more than almost 100% of government revenues comes from the oil and gas sector. But in Indonesia, the sectors together, I mean, the energy sector overall, including electricity, contributes around 16% of Indonesia GDP. But still, that is a very important share. However, there is another aspect to energy and to oil and gas relevance to the economy, that is subsidies. There are very generous subsidies on consumption, and they are eating hugely from government budget. I think the bill was around $20 billion in 2012 in terms of fuel subsidy bills to the government.
And, of course, that's one of the issues with the presidential election that's going on at present in Indonesia. Presumably, whoever gets in is going to have to address that eventually, because it's just a tremendously expensive burden on the government.
That's correct. I mean, we when I was there, we heard several ministers. I don't know if they would be part of the new government. We have to wait and see. But they were all talking about the need to reform the domestic subsidies. Actually, they tried to increase a little bit the prices in 2013, but they still have a long way to go. Otherwise, as I said, it's putting a huge burden on the government.
And as you said, unlike some of the Middle Eastern countries, including Kuwait, which we discussed a few weeks ago, Indonesia has managed to successfully diversify. But at the same time, it, as you said, wants to actually increase investment in its oil and gas sector. Should you actually, you mentioned some of the oil majors as a way of getting exposure to Indonesian oil and gas. Is that the way that you would recommend listeners to actually go about doing so, to buy the Chevrons and BPs of the world, rather than trying to get companies that might have a larger exposure to Indonesia?
Yeah, I mean, these companies, as I said, the oil majors, such as the BPs and the Exxons of this world, they have a well-diversified portfolio, and they have been in Indonesia for many, many years. So they have a good understanding of the system there, of the geology, of the relationship with the government, and with particularly the state oil company, that is Pertamina. So I would definitely go through these big players, although there could be opportunities for small players, especially when it comes to unconventional oil and gas or shale and oil and gas resources. Indonesia is sitting on substantial resources in this sector. And as you saw in the U.S., it has been the scene of the smaller companies, not the big companies. So there could be a bit of everything, but the first route for the risk averse would be the big players.
It's interesting that Indonesia has shale oil and gas as well as conventional, because obviously we've seen with the US what a major transformation has occurred through accessing new reserves that technology has made possible. Is there any likelihood of substantial supplies from that source coming on in Indonesia in the next 3 to 5 years, or is this at the moment still very much a longer term story?
No, I think a 4 to 5 year time is a bit optimistic, because what amazed me about Indonesia when I looked at this country was the diversity of resources that they have. But yet, you know, they are unable to bring these resources above ground because they don't have the same competitive, transparent environment that you find in the USA. And I think this is the main handicap in Indonesia, the regulatory environment and the policies rather than the shortage of resources. And as I said, these resources that are unconventional, they are not easy to get out. So you need the right framework to encourage companies to invest in them. And I would like to see that happening both for conventional and unconventional resources. But 4 to 5 years' time is a bit optimistic.
Okay. So just to finish up here then, Carol, would you feel that we're likely to see some improvement in the investment environment by Indonesia over the next couple of years, as has been talked about by government ministers and the rest, and which has been a source of frustration to the oil majors? It's evident the government recognises there's a problem. Do you think that they might actually do something about it in a relatively short period of time?
Yeah, the government is realising this problem. As I said, they are looking at it very closely. Now, I'm optimistic in terms of improving the regulatory environment for the existing oil and gas producers, giving them some fiscal incentives here and there. But in terms of a wide-ranging reforms transforming the country, as we know, this takes time to implement, particularly the removal of subsidies. That is a bit painful to remove at one go, and it's politically difficult to implement.
No, you're absolutely correct, Carol. And the danger of social unrest is something that always has to be borne in mind when you're attempting to remove subsidies from what people regard as necessities. Thank you very much indeed for that. That's a very insightful look. And we hope to have you back soon.
Thank you very much.
Thanks to energy economist Carol Nackley in London for that look at Indonesia, where she was recently, and its oil and gas sector. Again, it's interesting to note that a country that was part of OPEC and is now no longer a member of OPEC, they claim they can't afford to pay the dues, but is recognising, as has been the case with Mexico and to a certain degree Nigeria, that regardless of how extensive your resources are, if you don't actually get investment from cutting-edge producers such as the major, the oil majors, you run the risk of your production starting to decline. And for that, you need transparency and a welcoming environment. So we've come to the end of this edition of Emerging and Frontier Markets Investing. Today, we've looked at the effect of U.S. foreign policy on some of these markets. We've had the opportunity of taking a closer look at Colombia, Mozambique, Indonesia, and the ABCs of investing in Africa. Next week, I'll be back again with our global roster of contributors for another series of reports, including, we hope, something on the situation in Iraq, which is evolving very rapidly, but obviously it may not necessarily mean that it's a bad place to invest by when there's blood in the streets, as Baron Rothschild used to say. I'm Gavin Graham. Our producer is Al Emmett. We are the co-authors of Investing in Frontier Markets and are available in English-speaking markets around the world and on Amazon.com and also Frontier Markets for Dummies, which is now out. We're the publishers of the EFMI newsletter I mentioned during the program, and this radio program, our books and the newsletter mean we believe we're one of the leading sources of information about emerging and frontier investing. For more information, please write to info@emergingfrontier.ca. Again, that's info@emergingfrontier.ca. Thanks very much. Join us again next week.
Thanks for listening today to Emerging and Frontier Markets Investing with host Gavin Graham. Be sure to join us again next Wednesday at 6 a.m. Pacific Time, 9 a.m. Eastern Time on the Voice America Business Channel for another edition. Have a profitable week.